and welcome to this new episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast by RFI English. I'm Melissa Shimam. This week, we're going to Harlem, then to Paris via Africa. 2025 marks the anniversary of the birth, 100 years ago, of Malcolm X, Patrice Lumumba, and Frantz Fanon. And a series of films retrace the journey and the work of the latter. Frantz Fanon is an icon for some, especially in his homeland, Martinique, in the United States and in parts of Africa. But he's less known to others, especially in France, where he had nonetheless joined the forces of the French Liberation Army to fight Nazism in 1944, then traveled to Lyon to study medicine and become a psychiatrist in the early 1950s. That's also when and where he wrote his first noted book, Black Skin, White Mask, digging into the experience of alienation due to racism and the constant feeling of othering black people and especially black men went through in mainland France. Born on the 25th of July, 1925, 100 years ago then, in the French Caribbean, Frantz Fanon began his career in Blida, Algeria, as the land was still the jewel of the French colonial empire. He then soon joined the rebellion against colonialism and revolutionized the practice of psychiatry in colonial spaces. Algeria is also where he wrote most of his groundbreaking book, Les Derniers de la Terre, The Wretched of the Earth. To look at the influence of his work from the 1950s to our days, this week I speak with Rico Speck. He's an American independent producer, director, and writer of films and theater. He's based in Harlem, New York. He's the director of Redécouvrir Fanon, or Rediscovering Fanon, a documentary film screened in Paris on Saturday, the 5th of July, at the Town Hall. Rico, welcome to Spotlight on Africa.
Hello, it's really good to talk about Rediscovering Fanon. We released our film, Rediscovering Fanon, at the end of last year, and we're premiering it in Paris at July 5th. We'll also be showing it in Martinique July 16th. So we're just so happy to be able to talk about it with you.
And what I would like to know is how you started being so interested in Frantz Fanon as an American, and he's a French, Martinique, Algerian. And also when you decided that you could do a film about Fanon, because we all know it's not always easy to tell in pictures the story of a writer, of an anti-colonial hero. So how did it start for you?
I started this project in 2007. My initial interest in this subject goes back early. I'm from North Carolina. That's in the American South.
Yes.
Where issues of race and privilege and power are very, prominent. And when I was a teenager, I had an uncle who introduced me to another philosophical thinker, Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And so he told me I should read this. My uncle told me, you need to read this essay, Compensation. So that was I didn't know that was the beginning, but it was, because in college, when I was assigned to read Fanon, I saw that there was some kind of collaboration, I felt, in terms of this idea, Emerson's notion that every action has its own moral weight. It kind of aligned with Fanon's argument that, colonial violence scars both the people who are oppressed and those who are doing the oppressing. And so this idea that the universe kind of remembers the actions and that the consequences obtain really kind of support what I found out with Fanon. So that really resonated with me. It was also a way to be relieved, because, you can get angry and feel that things are unfair and that you personally need to kind of create a balance because things are unfair. But when you have the idea that there's a problem, but it's a problem that belongs to everybody, and to the extent that each person is involved in solving that problem, to that extent, are they in a better position? So it's not on me to solve the problem for everybody. The problem that people have, whether they're white and they're having problems with superiority, that unless they get their resolve and find their way back to humanity, that's on them. To the extent that any African-American or Black or whatever minority, that those people are involved with, kind of internalizing this inferiority, to the extent that those people can get beyond that, that's on them. So this kind of way of not having to like take on all of that was just so refreshing, to understand that. And so that was the beginning of my interest in Fanon, because of, especially in Black Skin, White Mask, where he's really talking about that, And I think that that's a different way than the way that is in the typical discourse. That's not the way it's looked at. They're problem people, are creating problems for everybody. So, Fanon was a good way, a good understanding. So it's that understanding. And I just felt, because I was doing other work on other issues, in one film I did, it's called Who's Gonna Take the Weight? And it looked at young people in the United States approaching the end of apartheid, comparing them to young people in South Africa approaching the end of apartheid, and looking at how they were, imbalances or similarities and all of that. So, I was already looking at these kinds of questions and these kinds of issues. And then Fanon just seemed like the next logical step.
Brilliant. And what did you want to do about Fanon with your film? Is it about retelling his life, or do you go from one particular text, particular book, or one moment of his life that you think will bring a new light to a new public with your own writing, your own style?
It's a combination. It looks at his life, his thought, as a psychiatrist, as an anti-colonial theorist. It looks at it through the lens of contemporary struggles. So while it's tracing his life, it's also looking at his ideas in the context of some of the issues that we are dealing with, especially because it took so long to do it. So it started to look at the issues that happened here in the United States, because I'm here. Trayvon Martin, George Floyd, and even the 2021 Capitol attack, all these things that were coming up. And so the application to me of Fanon's ideas to those kind of questions made those questions and made those occurrences kind of align in terms of the concepts that Fanon was espousing. So we're looking at both. It does inform, follow the trajectory of Fanon's biography. We start in Martinique, and then we go to the time in Europe, and during that Europe part, also kind of intercutting American stuff. And then we go to Algeria, where he ended up, So it's kind of following that, but it's raising questions along the way. We have a number of people, some of the people from his family, like we have his son, Olivier, we have his daughter, Mireille, we have his niece, her name is Francilène Fanon. She's a psychologist who's based in Martinique. We had his first cousin, who was his childhood playmate. His name was Fulbert. So we had those family folk. Then we also had Dr. Alice Shirky, who was Fanon's intern at one point, to kind of give that perspective. And through it all, we also had a narrative voice in a way. This Fanon scholar that I've met along the way, his name is Lewis Gordon. He's the head of the philosophy department. He's written, a lot on Fanon. So we have those voices that are really kind of looking at these contemporary issues and trying to find the relevance of Fanon's ideas to each of those occurrences.
You're listening to Spotlight on Africa with Melissa Schemann.
What is interesting is also the evolution of the reception and perception of Fanon's life and writing throughout the different generations after his passing. I'm talking to you from France, and I can see that there was a time here where Fanon's voice was very silent in France. And I think the new generation is really interested in rediscovering him. And one thing that is certain is that the United States, through the voice of people like you, actually never forgot Fanon. So can you say a little bit about that? I'd like to know how it works for you and how difficult or how actually easy it is to talk about Fanon now.
Yeah, I think there's a receptivity to Fanon's ideas again. I mean, I think that for generations, each generation sort of, as in terms of his own quote, they kind of have to become aware and then take responsibility as they will. So I feel like that's happening again. And I feel like the film is helping to kind of bring that back, into focus. As we know that in terms of the United States, one of the ways that Fanon's ideas became really popularized was during the period of the Black Panther Party. One of the interviewees, Daruba Ben-Wahad, talks about how Wretched of the Earth was like essential reading for them in the 1960s. So that kind of connection did obtain there, and it kept it active in a certain way. And the idea also that Fanon, I mean, this, you know, how uncanny is it that Fanon just happens to be born a month after Malcolm X, and that they're echoing similar themes. And so there was always that connection between Malcolm X and so many others, but particularly those two, because they both are celebrating the same centenary, 1925, when they were born, Malcolm in May and Fanon in July. In the documentary, we try to make that connection, you know, in terms of the kinds of ideas, because so many people on this side, almost absolutely everybody, whether they're in, the boomer generations or all the X's and all these other generations, everybody knows about Malcolm X, you know? And so if you can make that connection, it really helps to proliferate, you know, that when people understand that there's connection. So there was that, and we had that to work with and to build on. And that's what we've done. But we've also worked with organizations that were doing that same kind of work. And that is also important in the film, who also have those direct connections with people from different generations. For instance, in the film, we have people, an organizer from something here called the December 12th Movement. And they did a lot of mobilizing around the killing of Michael Brown that was in 2014. And so they were there. And so these are people who really see that, you know, the connections are ever there. And I think that that made it a little bit more receptive. In terms of overseas, at least in France, you know, I was able to understand that there were differences between how Fanon was remembered in the United States compared to other settings. Even in Martinique, you know, this idea that Fanon as a voice that is still relevant and known was similarly different than in the United States. And so even when we talked to people there were people that were close with Fanon, like Aimé Césaire, whose names is like household. But Fanon's name was not similarly household, even in Martinique. So I think that there is a difference in how Fanon's influence has been active throughout these time periods.
Another element, of course, and I find that is sometimes forgotten, is that Frantz Fanon was actually working very much and very deeply the last year of his life in the rest of Africa, not only Algeria. Algeria wasn't free, but Ghana was independent and he traveled there. And you mentioned Malcolm X, but Fanon is also born the same year as Patrice Lumumba,
That's right.
the
That's right.
iconic prime minister of the Congo. So was this something that you could embrace, making the film from New York with this connection in Paris and Martinique? Do you think that Fanon is also an African icon?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the things that, in terms of my own personal background, one of the projects that I did was an off-Broadway production of Aimé Césaire's A Season in the Congo. So I was really deeply involved with the whole experience, which was Fanon as well, you know, was very, very involved with that, how that all unfolded. And as you say, how Fanon, as a voice of decolonialization, has continued to be actively restored and honored, even in South Africa. So I, you know, so here I am in all these projects that I'm doing, that it's coming up again, that Fanon's voice in terms of inspiring the young people who were toying, you know, in the 1980s to really become actively again engaged with Fanon in terms of that anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. It became completely active. And then now, 25 years later, when the students are protesting the implementation of fees in South Africa and protesting that, Fanon again invoked in those struggles, as well as now Fanon being invoked in the struggles for the protests in Palestine. I mean, every struggle in which the issue of decolonization is heightened, there's a natural entree to the reintroduction of Fanon. Because, I mean, Fanon has said that decolonization is always violent. It's not that, you know, he was espousing violence. He's just saying that because of the nature of the relationships within those kind of paradigms, that violence is already there. And so that the ability to negotiate it has obviously already been settled. And it's not that, you know, the people who are the subaltern, that they can run away from it, you know, because I think it's important for them. So I feel like that connection between Fanon and struggles across generations and also across spaces is completely current in a certain way, ever there. Yeah.
I just want to ask you as well, what will be the life of the film? So you're coming to Paris to show it. It's the world premiere somehow. And then are you going to festivals? Are you going to show it all over the world? I mean, I guess it's going to show it in the US as well. So tell us a bit about the prospects.
Thank you. The appetite of programmers right now for films that look at subjects like Fanon, that look at subjects like the 2021 Capitol uprising that are critical, those are not the kind of subject matters I think that some programmers are looking for. I've had much better reception with previous projects than this in terms of festivals, but for sure. But the film has been selected for the Amicorti International Film Festival. That's in Italy. It's right around, it's just ending now in Italy. It also won awards for what's called the New York Documentary Film Awards. It also won the Bangkok Movie Awards, and it was a finalist for the London Director Awards. So, it's getting around. My obligation, because this is the centenary, is to do everything that's humanly possible to get the film out in every possible way. And that's what I'm doing. I'm giving it this full year. This is his year, and I'm here to, I'm committed as he's committed, and I'm going to do everything I can to get it there. We still haven't had a New York premiere. We've shown excerpts of it at the New School here, and it's very well received. But these are people, not the programmers, you know?
Well, thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure having you on.
Melissa, thank you so much. Thank you very, very much for being interested.
This was Rico Speck, an American independent producer, director, and writer of film and theater based in Harlem, and the director of Rediscovering Fanon.
You're
You're
listening
listening
to
to
Spotlight
Spotlight
on
on
Africa
Africa
with
with
Melissa
Melissa
Shamam
Shamam
on
on
Radio
Radio
France
France
International.
International.
Now we head back to Paris at the headquarters of UNESCO, the UN agency in charge of promoting education, science, and culture. The organization launched a thorough investigation into all aspects of the book industry in Africa, from novel and poetry writing to publishing, educational textbooks, library increase, and bookselling. We received Caroline Munier, a cultural programmer at UNESCO, to discuss the findings, and you'll see there is a lot to be happy about.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm Caroline Munier, and I was very pleased to lead this project about carrying out this study on the African book industry, for which I've worked with my colleagues in Africa, a great team, over the past year and a half.
What prompted the launch of this report?
As you may know, Africa is a priority region for UNESCO and the United Nations in general. And UNESCO has been working on doing these studies about mapping the cultural and creative industries in Africa since a number of years. And we had started with the film sector in 2021 and then the fashion sector in 2023. So naturally, we were just going through the different industries and followed by the book industry. And this was very important for UNESCO to do this study, although very challenging, because book is really at this intersection between culture and education, which is the other core mandate of UNESCO. That's how it came out.
And of course, for years we've known that a lot of books in Africa are actually produced and published abroad, mostly in Europe. How would you say the report has allowed you to see how this has changed now? It's a very big region, and but I'm sure there are hot spots of the publishing book industry that you've been focused on. But how would you say are the great trends of the past decade and the past 20 years, maybe?
First of all, to do this study, it was a collaborative work, and we tried to go really as much as possible close to the ground because there is no data. There is a big lack of data. So to be able to say what are the big changes in terms of quantitative data over the past 30 years is very difficult because we have no baseline. So I can give you the data we were able to collect. In order to be able to collect this data, and that's why it's a big report, there are a lot of data at the end. We have been working with more than 40 local experts. experts, African experts in all the countries, all the 54 member states of UNESCO in Africa. It's not an academic report. It was really through the questionnaire, which was sent out to all the member states. And we had a great response rate, which was 90%, which means that only 5 countries out of the 54 did not respond. What came out as big trends, let's say, is that, first of all, there is really a vibrant ecosystem. We have 6,400 publishers, 86,000 titles per year, as an average, of course, at the continental level, annually, 13,000 bookstores, 8,000 public libraries, and 270 festivals and book fairs annually, which is a lot, and 200 professional associations across the continent. And also, what we've noticed are the different emerging formats that we have. We see now a lot of graphic novels, comics, a lot of focus on publishing for youth, and also a new trend of African books being made into films. Netflix has taken quite a number of them. Other evolution or trends would be the increasing of publishing in local languages. It's still very weak, but still, over the past decades, a lot of local publishers have emerged and have tried to put the focus on the indigenous and local languages beyond the official foreign languages like French, English, and Portuguese. And this is growing. And this, of course, is what UNESCO is encouraging a lot in order to have more contextualized reading. In terms of access to books, we can see also an evolution in the sense that great efforts have been made to have reading centers, community centers, public libraries as much as possible across the continent and in the different countries and in rural areas, but still it's very weak. But we see that there is a willingness to do so. And perhaps a last point, in terms of gender equality, we see more and more encouraging steps toward gender equality. A lot of women in terms of writers, of course, but also as leaders in the industry. Still, there is a way to improve, of course, but it's growing. So it's very encouraging.
I was wondering about the languages, as you've mentioned, because for long, English and probably French, Portuguese, Arabic were dominating. It's actually showing diversity and energy in this book sector. It's not an obstacle, right? It's becoming something that's probably driving people to write.
This has started a long time ago, I would say, with authors like Ngugi Wa Thiong, who just passed, these kind of authors which really put this emphasis about Africans have to write into their local languages, first to be able to shape their narratives and to be able to transmit their own message, and second, of course, for the readers. I mean, you need to read in your own languages so that it's more contextualized. For the education side, it's very important, and UNESCO is also pushing this to have textbooks in local languages with contextualized and adaptive content also. That's very important. Swahili is very pushed also because it's a language the governments of those countries have promoted. The challenge is perhaps that to sell books also outside the country in local languages might be difficult. And because at the end of the day, it's a business, no, for publishers. If you publish in local languages, you need also to have your return on investment. So that you have your national market, but also how do I expand beyond?
And then maybe have you noticed any large or deep differences according to African regions?
Across all the regions, we have dynamic sectors. We see in all parts of Africa, countries which are now becoming hubs or trying to position themselves as hubs. So for example, if I take West Africa, we see that Senegal is a traditional, very strong country in terms of book industry. But we now see Côte d'Ivoire, Ghana, with the different festivals and book fairs, which are growing and trying to also support the neighboring countries. Nigeria is, of course, traditional, also very big country, also because of the population and the role it plays in Africa. In Central Africa, we have Cameroon, which also is more traditional one, which is a country and which has this dual Francophone and Anglophone parts. In terms of Southern Africa, South Africa is clearly positioning itself in a strong leader in the region, but also at continental level, trying to strive a bit. North Africa, I would say that, yeah, Egypt, of course, is very strong with the International Book Fair of Cairo, which is a big book fair, internationally recognized. But also we have seen in Morocco with the Salon du Livre de Rabat, which is now also growing up. And perhaps in Eastern Africa, Kenya is leading, also because of its position economically. Now, in terms of difference across the different regions, we could say that legislation are stronger in Northern and West Africa, because the study we made was very interesting, was to see which countries have a dedicated law on the book industry. We are not talking here about copyrights or legal deposit that almost all countries have, which is already a great step and a primary step to have a book industry. But we were looking more into which country really dedicate a law on the whole value chain of the book industry, because all is interlinked. So if you really want to develop the industry, you have to look at everything at the same time. And we only have five countries out of the 54: Burkina Faso, Algeria, Cameroon, Côte d'Ivoire, and Mauritania. And these are recent laws that they have, and they really put this focus on trying to think, okay, how can I develop this industry as a whole? From the access to books to publishers and edit and the selling and training and so on. So that's perhaps one difference. And then we have those traditional differences we can see between Francophone and Anglophone, I mean, English-speaking countries. Perhaps there is more focus on the market and private sector, which is stronger, but that's more or less, let's say, the difference. But otherwise, we see the same challenges across the continent.
And then I was wondering if any change in the rise of digital platforms or e-books had been positive or negative. I guess it's bringing less money, or do you see these changes that actually the whole world is seeing, publishing a lot more, the life of a book being much shorter and a lot of the reading being now digital? Is it also happening in these African hotspots? And is it something that could become a positive push, or is it a challenge mostly?
This is happening, of course. I mean, Africa has been a leader even back to 10, 15 years ago in developing this digital way of reading, because we know that in Africa, smartphones and all the digital high-tech tools are there and very present in the daily life anyway. Really, it was one of the first regions to go on this way. Unfortunately, then it was not followed by the investment it would have deserved to really flourish and explode. But still, we see over the past years a big push on the digital, and of particularly of young publishers trying to go out of the traditional ways of publishing because they don't feel they have the support they need and the legal environment they need. So going more on the digital, which of course can play this transformative role as everywhere, with the challenge you mentioned about piracy, because of course there is a lot of piracy. We were not able to measure that in terms of quantitative data because there is no data. It's very difficult, and piracy is more on the side of the educational books. But still, we do feel that the digital is an opportunity in terms of access also, of access to books and also to reach out to a wider audience. In terms of revenues, of course, it's very difficult to calculate, but what we could evaluate, we measured that the book industry nowadays represents about $7 billion, which is 5.4% of the global market, which in fact is very low, because if we think that Africa represents 18% of the population worldwide. And the projection we could make is that the book industry could, if everything was in place in terms of legislation, support, etc., the projection is that the book industry could generate 18.5 billion, which is more than the double that it is now. And these figures are really conservative figures because we were able only to measure the formalized part of the industry. There is a lot of informal industry, informal economy, and the digital was not measurable in this. So you see that there is a way to really take advantage of the digital in multiple ways.
Well, then that's really, really interesting. Maybe you just want to say a few words on the recommendations you've come up with that could support these positive changes and improve the industry in the coming years.
Yeah, sure. So while looking at all the challenges, we could see three main bunch of recommendations or call for action, let's say. The first is really the institutional and legislative framework. We do need to have stronger frameworks to support, in terms of policies, all this ecosystem and all the stakeholders at the different level of the book value chain. So we have the writers, But then we have the publishers, the distributors, so librarians, and then of course the reading centers and so on, until the access to books. That would be one of the big recommendations. But also putting in place institutions such as, for example, national book development councils, which would gather all these actors to have this dialogue and to decide together how to go forward with industry in the country. The second big recommendation or call for action is about building a strong domestic market. We could evaluate that as an average, 70% of the market is about educational books, textbooks, and so on, which responds to a need, in Africa. There was not so much countries in the end which really produced locally with local publishers. So there is a big reliance on foreign publishers for the textbooks. So this is a loss in terms of revenues. So the idea here is really to encourage states to build this strong domestic market by first integrating the book sector into their national industrial development strategies to really see the book industry as an industry. So this means to have not only the ministries of culture and education involved in that, which traditionally the two ministries looking at books, but also to have the Ministry of Planning, Ministry of Industry, to really look at this as the industry from the economic part. And then to implement procurement policies, incentives, and fiscal incentives for this domestic market in order to encourage the local publishers. The third recommendation or call for action is about expanding readership and access to books. Because, as we say, without readers, you don't have a book industry. So, the idea is to invest in public library infrastructures in order to really have libraries in every part of the continent. Nowadays, we have, as an average on the continent, one public library per 189,000 people. There are countries where you have one public library per more than 1 million people. So, of course, how can you then have people buying books if they don't have this sensitization and access to books? The same for bookstores. We have, as an average, one bookstore per 117,000 people, which means much more in some parts and much, much less in some other countries. So, we really need to have a strong support and investment in public libraries, but also in terms of infrastructures about access to books. And part of this is also the support to digital publishing platforms, to look at the digital platforms as a complementary ways of the physical bookstores in terms of access to books.
And maybe you want to mention a couple of these events, like the biggest book fairs or festivals.
Yeah, most of them I think are taking place more in the first semester of the years, but we start in February in general with the Cairo Book Fair in Egypt. We had in April Salon International du Livre de Rabat. Rabat has been nominated also by UNESCO as the World Book Capital for 2026, so it's also a big very important. In Accra, we have also a big book fair, and I think one is coming up in August. And we have another very increasing book fair, which is in Côte d'Ivoire, in Abidjan, Salon International du Livre d'Abidjan, early May. And recently we had one also very interesting in end of May in Libreville, in Gabon. It was more focused on the young people literature. So, and of course, the Kenyan book fairs are also very important. More or less in terms of events, that's what's going on. For UNESCO, we celebrate this year the 20th anniversary of the adoption of our Convention on the Protection and Promotion of the Diversity of Cultural Expressions, which is this international instrument governing the cultural and creative industries. That is why also for us it was very important to have this report out this year. When we think about the global context we are evolving in terms of cultural diversity, it's very important to be able to reinforce this aspect of humanity that we need to promote. We need to encourage, to protect very strongly. And for that, we need books. We need to have people reading books. And through books, you discover other cultures. First, you understand your own culture, your neighbors, but also you understand the foreigners and you open your mind simply. And we need this mind openness nowadays more than ever. So that's why we really call to everyone celebrating cultural diversity and to read books, physical or digital. Just read.
Amazing. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
This was Caroline Munier, a cultural programmer at UNESCO. This was the latest episode of Spotlight on Africa, a podcast produced by RFI English. It was mixed by our dedicated sound engineer, Erwan Rome. Thanks, Erwan. Thanks to all our guests, and thanks to you for listening. We're heading into a short summer break and we'll be back for another episode in September. In the meantime, for more African news, go to our website rfi.fr/en/Africa.